So if you could see radio waves with your eyes, and you went out to a quiet place to look for radio waves, you'd have to have no cell phone service and not have any TV stations like in the center of South Africa. And you looked at the sky, you'd see the Milky Way glowing, and it would be red. Long wavelength synchrotron emission makes the long wavelengths brighter. And you'd see point sources on the sky, not stars, they're extragalactic, they're radio galaxies covering the sky. And as you watched, you'd see flashes appear on the sky. About every 2 minutes, you'd see a bright flash, much brighter than those radio galaxies, Jansky's in intensity, and one every few minutes, flash on the sky. And they would sweep from blue to red, to long, short wavelengths first, arriving first, if you had gigahertz frequency eyes. And they're very bright. And so that's a radio burst. I'm going to tell you about those radio bursts today. They were missed by radio astronomy for 50 years. But they're very bright. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, these radio bursts, what they are, what they're good for, and how we're going to understand this better. Oh, I got to turn this on here. PowerPoint. Okay. So this is data, a radio burst signal. And this is the start of a new type of radio telescope called HIREX. I'm going to talk about HIREX. We'll have 1,000 of these dishes arrayed together in a packed array in South Africa in a few years. This is one that we discovered, so I'll spend a bit of time on that. Here's the outline. I'll talk about the roughly 25 published radio bursts. They do seem to be extragalactic with redshifts up to about 1. There's very good evidence of that. That's accumulated over time. The case has been building. And now I think the acceptance is very broad that these are cosmological distances. If so, they're very bright. The inferred brightness temperature, pretending they're isotropic, they're probably not, but to scale them on an even scale with everything else, you calculate an inferred isotropic brightness temperature, and that number is 10 to the 35 Kelvin for these objects. It's an outstandingly high number. It's about the highest in all of the field of astrophysics for brightness temperature, close to the highest. I'll show you more about that. There are many wild ideas. There are more theories than data points to explain this incredibly high brightness temperature. There are also a lot of them. So they're very bright and they're common. About 5,000 per day all sky. We did detect one, and I'll spend some time on the one we detected. Since that data come out, we had our 15 minutes of fame here with this one. But we're now eclipsed by an even more interesting event for which there's actually an optical counterpart. That's the first time that's been shown. So this is the one that really convinces everyone that they are in external galaxies. I'll then talk about these coming telescopes and focusing on HIREX, but there are a couple of others that will localize these sources on the sky and find many, many more of them than we've found so far. And that's the agenda. So here's the discovery event, the famous Lorimer burst, submitted in 2006, published 2007. Dark is bright, and the white lines here are just to mark the lambda squared dispersion that you expect from a distant source. So those are to guide the eye. These sources are dispersed in frequency, so they arrive later at longer wavelengths. And you see that in the spectrum here with the pulse arriving later. This is cold plasma delay from the electron density integrated column density of electrons along the line of sight. So I'll explain that in a second. You have to remove that. This is why these were missed for 50 years, because they are spread out in frequency and time. So if you look with a narrow band of frequencies, you don't see it. What you have to do to have good sensitivity to these pulses is guess an example of this dispersion measure, what the slope of this curve is, and take it out, slide them all over so they line up, integrate in frequency, and then you get a high signal noise event. But that's a search that people didn't bother to do for 50 years. Yeah. Okay. Here's the story of the dispersion measure. The free electrons in the plasma oscillate in response to the electric field coming in, and they make a forward scattered wave, which delays the wave in effect. So this is the standard creation of an index of refraction, but it goes as lambda squared, or nu to the minus 2. And here's the formula in milliseconds, 4.5 times this dispersion measure, which is the column integrated electron density in parsec per cubic centimeter units. Okay, so that's dm. So a typical dm dispersion measure for a pulsar is about 50. They're galactic objects. These objects have 10 times the dispersion measure, and that's one of the indicators right away that they're outside the galaxy. Right. I'll show you more about that. Okay, now this discovery event was found with Parkes, and Parkes has this multi-beam feed, corrugated feeds that all look into the dish, 13 of them. And one of the key indicators that it was real is it's found in just one. The object has to be above the ionosphere in order to focus to just one pixel here. So that means they're far-field objects. For this Lorimer event, if you we know something about the electron density in the intergalactic medium, and if you take out the Milky Way component and then integrate over what's left, you guess that this object that Lorimer detected would be at redshift of a half. Right, and yet it's incredibly bright, 30 Janskis. Right. So here's kind of a summary of the story of the data that's been published so far. Peak fluxes in the 1 to 100 Jansky range. Now, the extragalactic radio sources that I talked about that are all over the sky, galactic nuclei and jets, those are millijansky typically. So these are very bright by radio astronomy standards. They are highly dispersed, as I mentioned, pulse widths of about a few milliseconds. All but one have never been seen to repeat. These fields are repeatedly returned to see if there's a pulsar there. Deep integrations are done. And there's, except for one, no repetitions. Now, one of them does repeat, and we'll say more about that later. About 15% seem to have this late-time scattering tail. You see the decaying exponential on this tall pulse. Now, this one might have a decaying exponential on it, but it disappears in the noise here, right? So maybe that's got a decaying exponential you're just missing, right? But anyway, there's a detected decaying exponential on about 15% of them. Positions are not very accurate because these are single dish radio telescopes and the diffraction limit is about 15 arc minutes, half the size of the full moon. Out to redshift one, there will be typically 100 galaxies on a field this size, so you simply don't know what the source is with a single dish radio telescope. Right, they're not concentrated in the galactic plane, I'll show you that. The rate's about 5,000 all-sky per day. They've been detected now with four different telescopes. The one that repeats, 121102, does have an optically detected counterpart. So we know the redshift of that source, just that one. Okay, so here's a distribution in galactic coordinates of their dispersion measures. The blue points are pulsars. So those are mostly in the Milky Way. These are the large and small Magellanic clouds. But all the rest of these are in the Milky Way. So this is all known pulsars, all catalog pulsars. And you can see that looking into the galactic plane, you get this very large accumulation of electron density along the line of sight. And you can get very high dispersion measures right in the within a degree or so of the galactic plane. But the radio bursts, the green pulses, are outside the plane and yet have this enormous dispersion measure. Our event is the red star there. Right, so that's the first indication that they're extragalactic, but it's not ironclad because, of course, the source can have plasma too. We don't know what these objects are. They may be a new type of object. They may be in a molecular cloud or have a lot of plasma around them. That's always a possibility that could put them back in the Milky Way. Right. Now, I have to stop here, pause a second, and explain about a confusion in this field. There were a set of false positive events, and Duncan Larmor came up to Pittsburgh. He's in Morgantown, and he came up and gave a talk to our McWilliams group during this period of confusion when So they looked immediately through the archives of data to find more of these, and they found a lot of them. And a lot of them had the same dispersion measure, and sadly, they were coming in all the beams. So here are all the beams of the Parkes array, and every one has got this pulse in it, and they have all got the same dispersion measure. And so suddenly... Say what?
Do they correlate with light spectrum?
They do, basically. Yeah, they do. So this was explained. It took a long time to explain it, but eventually it was determined that, well, the story is that there's a microwave oven, and of course they're RF shielded. They have a door that closes and seals RF-wise. But they put that in an additional Faraday cage, and it was a 30-year-old Amana radar range, like an original one. And that works great, except if your soup boils over, what do? You grab open both doors, right? And that lets the decaying magnetron voltages sweep in frequency. It makes a fake radio burst just to confuse everybody. But for quite a while, there were people that were saying, these are all just microwave ovens, right?
It's just a coincidence that decays this frequency of the minus two.
It's pretty close. This one's got a kink in it, right? That one's not quite as good. Not quite a minus two. I mean, they're all sort of the same DM. Okay, so for a while we had the two camps, extragalactic camp and the microwave oven camp, right? You know, and what would really be interesting is if we're both right. That's what would really be fun, right? Yeah. But that's not true. All right. Well, brightness temperature. Let's talk about the brightness temperature. So, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Did it have a redshift? What was the redshift?
Well, we don't know the galaxies.
I know. You said there was one that was between.
One of them has redshift 0.2.
Right. Okay.
0.2. Yeah. I'll show you more about that.
And it's repeated. Okay. Yeah.
Only one has been. A counterpart's been identified. Okay, now another story of brightness temperature. So this is just a plot for transient events to spread them out in two dimensions. The dimensions are the inferred luminosity, the distance squared times the flux, and so that doesn't take into account beaming, right? So there's maybe a beaming factor in there. And then this is the number of cycles in the pulse, the frequency times the width of the pulse, right? So that's a dimensionless number telling you the number of cycles. And then you can plot contours of brightness temperature on here. And you're assuming that short pulses come from small objects, right? If it's a millisecond pulse, it's a light millisecond size object. So you know the size of the object as well. And that gives you a brightness temperature. So you plot this brightness temperature. And this is where, so these are contours of four orders of magnitude each dotted line here. And so we're up here near 10 to the 36 Kelvin inferred brightness temperature. Now, probably they are beamed, but you want to compare all objects on the same two-dimensional plot. But look at all the other things that are on here, flare stars, gamma ray bursts. You thought they were bright, right? Well, not in this scale, right? Pulsars are very bright. Pulsars occasionally emit anomalously bright pulses. Giant radio pulses, so those are these points up here. The crab pulsar has been seen to emit nanosecond pulses, so you realize it's coming from a region that big, right? And you're seeing it from 1,000 parsecs away. So it's this big, and 1,000 parsecs away you see the pulse. Amazing. That's the only thing that's brighter in these units, in all of astrophysics. So it's quite a challenge to explain this number, theoretically.
It's like the LHC?
What? Yeah.
Like the LHC?
I don't, we should
work
that out. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 10 to the 34 Kelvin is 10 to the 29 EV. Right.
No.
10 to the 5th EV is a Kelvin. Kelvin, 10 to the, EV is 10 to the 5 Kelvin.
This is super Planckian.
No, it's not. 10 to the minus 23 to convert Kelvin into EV, right?
No, it's
4
is a
minus. 1 EV is 10 to the 5 Kelvin.
10 to the 4, I would say.
10 to the 4.
Super
10 to the 4.
One EV is 10 to the 5 Kelvin.
Hey,
you know
what
this
is?
What?
You're using
what?
Well, let's talk about means afterwards.
It's not the temperature. It's misleading to talk about its brightness temperature. I mean,
it's not a physical temperature.
So, I mean, yeah, you're going to get some huge temperature in electron, but it doesn't mean anything. It's not like particles.
Yeah, this is not a thermal source.
Yeah.
So the number doesn't mean that. It probably means highly coherent.
It means highly coherent, right?
That's what it means. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, I mean, if you have... just thinking it's highly coherent, it's a lot of energy. You don't have anything. Is it more... The luminosity is like brighter than AGN.
Yes. Yeah. Brighter than AGN.
Yeah.
Or similar. Similar. Okay, so it's a theory group, so making these claims in this group is going to stimulate a lot of discussion. There are many, many papers about models, and some of them are crazy and interesting and fun. Starting close to home, maybe it's lightning. It's a hoax. Microwave ovens, those seem to have all faded away. Even flare stars in the Milky Way seem to not be possible. Pulsars, well, they don't seem to be in the Milky Way. What about supergiant pulses from extragalactic pulsars? That's kind of my favorite. We know that there is a tail of rare, very, very bright pulses from pulsars already. Maybe they're, five orders of magnitude greater size pulses that are extremely rare. And that's what we're seeing. That's kind of my favorite. However, the repeating event is clearly not one of those. So anyway, what other things have the right sort of time scales, like merging black holes might be right. Gamma ray bursts are generally not quite this short. They're generally longer seconds, sort of. Millisecond is kind of short for gamma ray bursts. Some people claim that they can do that. Yeah, it's hard. You have to have meaning. You have to have coherence. That's the secret to it, coherence. An FM radio antenna manages to have an extremely high brightness temperature because in a narrow band, 50 kilowatts comes out of a wire this long, right?
What is the temperature of an FM antenna?
I've not worked out the number, but I bet it exceeds this.
Yeah, that's what I would have.
I thought there were lasers that had brightest temperatures 10 to the 20 and things like that. Right? This is one of the great signs for like this coherent.
Uh-huh. 10 to the 20, you say.
Yeah.
This is more. This is 10 to the 28.
Yeah. Kind of a favorite model of mine is a supernova core collapse. That has a delayed final collapse to a black hole. So if you create a spinning black hole that has enough angular momentum, the same mass might collapse to a black hole if it were not spinning. And so you can give then the remnant time to evolve and collapse and become transparent. And then the core can slow down and it's spinning enough to suddenly collapse to a black hole. And so that's kind of, I think one of these is binary Blitzar model, and there's another spinning model. So that's kind of fun, except that there are 5,000 per day of these things. So wouldn't you think that would be a narrow range of supernova that would do that? So that has problems with the rate. So neutron star combinations, there are lots of neutron stars out there, maybe coalescences of neutron stars. Maybe they're worn-out pulsars, where the spin and magnetic field are aligned. Yeah?
Oh, I just wanted you to reiterate the rate problem. Is that enough? I don't hear it. Yeah. The core collapse supernova happened like once per 100 years in galaxies, is what you're saying.
Right.
It's to match the rate of FMVs. You need a rate at least no larger, not larger.
Yes, right. Right. That's right, yeah. Because this would be a narrow selection of the distribution of core collapse supernova that would happen to live just long enough to emit later. The rate of supernova, raw rate of supernova, is not too far off from this rate. So if every supernova was making an FRB, it'd be okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What else to say about this? There's lots to think about here. I want to talk about other things, but I'm sure this group is interested in this.
This 5,000 per day. Do you
you have to make some extrapolation to infer that, or is this just a
yes, you do.
Okay.
So we look with a 15 arc minute beam for 1,000 hours with a radio telescope, and we see one or two.
Yeah.
See, now what is the all sky rate? Assume it's uniform across the whole sky.
Okay, but that's a reasonable.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Okay. But we do make that extrapolation. And also, they continue when we're not looking.
Okay. Yeah. You don't have to assume something about their spectrum or something.
A very little is known about their spectrum. We don't have enough data to have.
But this 5,000 per day doesn't make an assumption.
No. Okay. No.
Well, if you want to extrapolate down to, if you want to forecast China high rates, then it matters a little.
Most of the observations are at higher frequencies than Chimer Hyrax. There are now, in the Chimer Hyrax band now, another set from Milonglo.
That's
okay.
Right.
So there used to be just one in that band, and now there are three, four, something like that. So we have a little more information about the Chime band.
Since if we see 5 a day
instead of 10 per day, I'm okay with that. Actually, I think they've been pretty conservative in those estimates, so it should be safe. All right, so now I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the one that we detected, because that's fun for me. So I'm also involved in 21 centimeter intensity mapping, and this is the scheme in which you map the universe not by finding individual objects with an optical spectroscopic survey, but just by taking the intensity along a line of sight from the 21 centimeter line and turning it into a density of material directly without going through the stage of finding galaxies. And this is about 100 times more efficient at mapping the sky than the old way of finding the galaxies individually. And we tried this out first on the Green Bank Telescope. Over the years, we accumulated 650 hours of time in this frequency band for the intensity mapping project. And we decided to search this data for radio bursts, since we had our own archive. We did detect, by the way, the 21 centimeter signal from redshift 1, first in cross-correlation with the Deep 2 catalog. So we're cheating, we're taking all the Deep 2 galaxies and stacking them and looking around that region for a falling profile of 21 centimeter intensity. And that is the profile right there that we get. So that's the 21 centimeter glow found in cross correlation. And now we're getting very close to detecting the power spectrum without cheating, just on the 21 centimeter autocorrelation signal. So that's how that's going. But we also looked for radio bursts.
Does this agree with the galaxy-galaxy correlation?
Yeah, well, it's the bias is likely to be pretty complicated for 21 centimeter. Yeah, within factor 2, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Within factor 2, yeah. 21 centimeter is, it's found in the outskirts of spiral galaxies. So that's a very dense object. It's not found then in clusters, which in cosmological scales are even higher peaks of density. So its bias is likely to be pretty complicated at the end of the day. Yeah. Yeah. For this project, we invented or revived, there was something about this published in 1974 by Joe Taylor, actually, but we ended up creating anew a folding type algorithm for trying all the dispersions very quickly. So that's called dedispersion. So you have a time frequency plot and you convert it to a dispersion measure time plot. This is our actual event and what it looks like in DMT space. So we invented this fast algorithm for that purpose. And Alex here, intern this summer, did this simulation right here and got to be an author on the paper. Okay, so here's a real event. Here's a simulation we practiced on. Here's a pulsar, and here's RFI. Now, Shushen Lin, my graduate student who searched the data to find that event, had to look through 6,000 of these to find the real one before he found the good one. So,
why are there multiple things at the bottom? The multiple stripes.
This is a pulsar. So that repeatedly pulses.
Yeah,
so these are a lot like pulsars, only just one pulse. You see the similarity, higher dispersion measure, more slope. but and not repeating.
Sorry?
These have more slope. You can't really see it here.
Yeah.
This one is repeating. It's a pulsar. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. So what is RFI? The last.
Yeah, that's radio noise from transmitters on planet Earth. We never know exactly what the transmitter was, but bursts of interference from someone's router or cell phone or airplanes flying over. There's a lot of that. This field is severely affected by radio.
Do you detect any differences between the fast radio bursts and the pulsar bursts? Or it's too
hot? Yeah, there are some differences. You know, we have evidence that there are two scattering screens, which we interpret as coming from the host galaxy and the Milky Way. And we can see that in the data for this event. Yeah. So, yeah.
So you think the pulsar is in the Milky Way, but the cluster of the West is outside?
Yeah. Right. I should slow down because the questions are better than the talk. questions are always very valuable. So anyway, Xuxian Lin did find this event by looking through 6,000 false positives and picking out the one good event. And then we had to model it very carefully and convince ourselves it was real. Here's a little blow up of the data, again with the lines to guide the eye. There is some scintillation, which is variation of intensity with frequency. There's also scattering. Those are the scattering is this tail of delayed arrival of the flux. And you know, both of these things are two different aspects of the same kind of thing happening. You have clumps of plasma in the intervening material, and you can either do a physical optics calculation or a ray type optics calculation. You can have paths that are delayed and thus the exponential decay. You can also have phase coherent addition of wavelets, amplitude components, which creates the scintillation with frequency. Right? It's also polarized. This is the first FRB data that had polarization. And we see the Q and U Stokes parameters rotate at 90 degrees out of phase with a lambda squared frequency variation, as you'd expect. So this is the Faraday effect, magnetic. It's linear polarization, yeah. This 90 degree phase shift means it's rotating on the sky with wavelength. We did not detect a circular polarization. Yeah. So if there's a magnetic field along the line of sight, you see a rotation of the angle, polarization angle on the sky, proportional to the integrated B component, B times E, electron density, along the line of sight. So it's, let's say, one component of a vector averaged along the line of sight.
So what magnetic field do you
see? Microgauss.
Okay, so it's interesting.
Yeah, it's...
So you think it's at the source?
We think it's probably at the source, yeah.
But microgauss is, probably the source is much bigger than magnetic.
Well, it's going to be some cancellation along the line of sight.
Microgauss is like that typical ISM.
Yeah, that would be galactic rather than
intergalactic. Oh, wait, so you mean the galaxy. Okay, so
yeah. Probably the host galaxy. We know something about the magnetic field in the Milky Way from the pulsar rotations, and that does not explain this. It's very likely in our source galaxy. Yeah. Although we don't know which. I did search the catalogs to try to pick out good candidate galaxies, but there were just too many. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so this was the first one found with the Green Bank Telescope, the first one found outside the 1.5 gigahertz band, the first with linear polarization. Yeah. Yeah, lambda squared. Yeah, it fits the expected lambda squared frequency.
Okay,
sorry.
Over what dynamic range?
Well, a factor 700 and 900 megahertz, so not a very wide range of frequencies. You can see the period changing in the data. So this is the lambda squared change of period of oscillation. Yeah, and you can see it's a pretty good fit, right? Within the errors of the data. Yeah.
So what was the ultimate for this one?
1.2 milliseconds
so
without the scattering.
Yeah, so is that the observed one, or that's after you correct for the dispersion?
It roughly doubles after the after the scattering.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So the scattering observed one was twice that, the number you said?
The scattering of the exponential decay and the width of the intrinsic pulse itself are about each 1.2 milliseconds.
You should have been blocked.
Yeah.
Blocked, you should.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, did I have that?
Should have.
Okay. Anyway, is that all you need? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, so we had, 15 minutes of fame from this event. It actually was picked up by 100 news outlets, and it was the number one science story in Google News for 24 hours. Actually, 48 hours. Science story, not. Yeah, that's right. Well over 15 minutes of fame. But now we're relegated to the dustbin pretty much because of this object. So one of the FRBs has been found to repeat, and it's the only one detected with Arecibo. They detected, these are nine different individual times when it flashed again. Now, immediately you'd say, is it periodic? Is this a pulsar? But it's not. It doesn't, it's only small sampling of data, but it doesn't fit any reasonable periodicity. So it appears to not be periodic, episodic. They come in groups. So it's quiet for periods of time, then it makes a few pulses sort of randomly, some of them brighter than others, right? And the frequency is shifting around. He said, we don't know much about the spectral index of these sources or the spectrum. Well, see, it's kind of peaking here, and then this one's peaking here. So it's kind of broad peaks that are moving around in the spectrum. So who knows? Who knows what's going on?
Sorry, just explain what
is. This is frequency, 1.2 to 1.5 gigahertz. And we're seeing a peak in the spectrum here. And then this one is peaking off at this end of the spectrum, right? And this one's peaking down here. So some few hundred megahertz wide hump in the spectrum that's moving around, I guess. Yeah.
What is the time difference between these?
They're days apart.
They're days apart.
These are different. These are this. Okay, hold on a second. So that's a particular day. Is this a different day? So I know it was seen on four or five different days, groups of pulses, seen on different days.
Scintillation thing. You were showing before. That's a much shorter time scale than scintillation
or a single. That's a much shorter time scale. Like, the delays through that cloud of plasma globs are 1 millisecond. 1 millisecond, yeah. And this is days or months. So these are new events at the source.
I'm just thinking that, I mean, if you're talking about intergalactic distances, then, I mean, the scintillation thing just could take much longer for
this? I don't think that's a viable model that months later a pulse arrives via a longer path. That's too much distance.
Well, that happens for lensing. These months later.
But. I guess you're right. It could have a lensing galaxy in between. Yeah.
But you are having lensing by the plasma, right? So it's not gravitational lensing, but lensing.
Well, I guess you could be right. So there could be a galaxy cluster along the line of sight in multiple paths.
How many
FRBs
are there?
25,
roughly.
Yes.
So
yeah. Yeah. Although there's a bias, we find the strong ones, which would be more likely lensed.
True.
Yeah.
And so, like for example, this last one we said was peaking above like 1.5 gigahertz of frequency.
This one here, I guess.
So you're not showing that because the...
This is the band they observed.
Right. So is it possible that there are other bursts above and below this?
Yeah,
band?
Quite possible. It's been a lot of work at very short wavelengths, or long wavelengths. LOFAR and MWA have searched for these events and not seen them. It's not talked about enough, that lack of detection often be 300 or 200 megahertz. Yeah, there probably what's happening is the scattering exponential time grows with four powers of frequency. And so what's happening, we're seeing a millisecond or so of scattering at 800. If you now carry that to 130 megahertz where LOFAR observes, it now becomes hundreds of milliseconds. And so the pulse is too spread out to find anymore. So probably they're scattered away from detectability for LOFAR and MWA. That's a good question. About 3 gigahertz, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure about that, but I think that's about right.
Didn't you share this a little bit ago? Rotation rate derived from 350 to 800.
700 and 900 was the band.
Oh.
700 and 900. Yeah. Right. There's also a large block of data at 327 that's used for pulsar searching. That's also come up dry. Yeah. This repeating object became a good candidate target for deep observations, and the VLA was used to observe this field, and also the European VLBI network was used, and it was detected with the large interferometer. And here's the data from the European VLBI network, and now the crosses are pulses. The gray and red crosses are individual pulses found on the sky with VLBI, and the cross is sort of the composite average best position that they give the black cross. And also in this image is a persistent radio source right here. So notice the coordinates, 33 degrees, 8 minutes, 52.53 arc seconds, 0.54 arc seconds. So this is 10 milli arc seconds, right? Right, about 20 parsecs at the source, which is a range of 0.2. So are these the same object, actually, the persistent radio source and the flash? Well, maybe. Yeah, it's very close. It's within 20 parsecs.
Long way.
Arc
so
minutes. I think it's statistically it's a little bit far off, right? But yeah, could be the same object. And now there's a very sharp position known, and we can observe optically at these coordinates. So this is a Gemini optical image. This source is very close to the galactic plane. It's in the anti-center region, so there are a lot of stars here. This is the guy. And there's a blow up of it. And actually, of course, it's known to a fraction of a pixel in this Gemini image where the source is. Right. And it's within that. And that is a dwarf galaxy, maybe 10 to the 8th or so stars total at redshift 0.2. An unremarkable sort of no spiral structure. Dwarf galaxy.
Old stars,
yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Is the pixel off-center or more centered?
What now?
Is the pixel off-center or more centered on the dwarf
galaxy? I think it's not centered on the optical center. It's off the optical center. The radio source seems to be not at the center. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, and that redshift 0.2 is consistent with the dispersion measure that's been seen. Okay, well, let's just spend a little time. I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's so far future. I mean, we have 20 events here, so we can't go too crazy about what these things are useful for, except that, of course, this is what a lot of people write papers about. But anyways, there are tons of papers about this. So what do we want to do with radio bursts ultimately? Well, of course, we want to understand this emission mechanism that makes the 10 to the 35 Kelvin isotropic equivalent temperature. We're getting three-dimensional data. Every event carries with it a dispersion measure, which is a distance measured basically in electron density units. So this is three-dimensional data, so you can do tomography with it. It's tomography of the ionized universe, which has never been done. So that would be exciting to do that. There is, in cosmology, a missing baryons problem. We know 4% of closure density is in baryons from CMB measurements. We can't find these baryons. All the stars, all the gas and galaxy clusters is probably a quarter of that, something like that. And most of it is missing. Where is it? It's probably ionized material in the intergalactic medium, which is what the gas that this is traveling through. So we should be able to find the missing baryons with this. And map them, right? You're going to get a power spectrum. You've got three-dimensional data. Of course, you're going to study it, just as we study every other three-dimensional probe of the universe using optical galaxies or 21 centimeter, whatever you've got. You're going to use it for cosmology, baryon acoustic oscillations, the shape of the power spectrum, study bias, redshift space distortions, non-Gaussianity. That will, of course, all be done with this data set as well. It's got a different bias from everything else, which helps you understand more about the evolving material. The scattering is about turbulence in the intergalactic medium. So we're going to learn about that, these cells that are doing the scattering. We're measuring a component of the magnetic field along the line of sight. So we're gaining information that's otherwise unavailable about magnetic fields in the intergalactic medium and also in the sources. Maybe difficult to unsort those two. Of course, we want to know, does this population vary with redshift? Is there a favored epoch for these objects? We don't know that yet. We want to look for gravitational waves coincident with these events. They're possibly very dramatic, right? Maybe this is neutron star coalescence and makes a gravity wave. So far, there's been no detection in looking on the LIGO data at the correct time. But with a large number of events and some stacking, maybe you will see a gravity wave signal.
Do you expect to see anything? I mean, it's at small energies compared to
that. What fraction of the total gravitational energy is the radio pulse? You tell me that number, and I'll give you an answer.
Well,
is it 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 18?
No, but I mean, the only way to get significant, obviously, I mean, if you destroy a neutron star or the two neutron stars merge, the type of energy you see is much less than that now. Of course, that could be, but I mean, that wouldn't be a repeating event. So unless you say that, yeah, there are two types and they're repeating and not repeating.
Right. I think that's, we don't know that yet, but I wouldn't be very surprised at all if we find that there are non-repeating events and repeating events.
Yeah. So if they're just repeating, then there isn't really enough energy to actually see it because if there is, then you're going to destroy it.
Okay, I think you might be right about that. I mean, I haven't done the numbers, but one model for the repeating event is that there's some accretion disk around a neutron star, and occasionally material gets into the very high magnetic field part just at the surface and makes a pulsar-like pulse.
Right.
And that happens every now and then. Right.
But then I don't think that would have much energy.
Yeah, that would not make a gravity wave. Yeah. Right. You can check this dispersion law, the lambda squared law. If the photon has a mass, it won't be lambda squared anymore. And we go down to very short, long wavelengths here. So this is one of the best measurements already on the photon mass, I think. I'm not really up to date on this, but the constraint from FRBs is about 10 to the minus 14 eV on the mass of the photon. Okay, what are we doing here? Got a few minutes. Okay, so now I want to talk about where do we go next? And I want to talk about these packed interferometers we've been inventing, and also about some interferometry we're hoping to do. And there are many groups around the world that are working on this, and I'm just focusing on the things we're working on. So let me tell you about HIRAX. So HIRAX is going to be an array of 1,024 6-meter dishes. Here's the first one. We get this from a company in China. I've been to the factory in Hebei province, and these are cheap. So we're going to pack 1,000 of them together in the Karoo Desert in the radio quiet zone in South Africa. and phase them all up in a big interferometer. So everyone will be sampled with the input to a large correlator computer. Not shown here is the three 40-foot trailers full of rack cabinets of supercomputer. There's a petaflop supercomputer on site to analyze the data from this. That's now not very expensive. You can get a petaflop supercomputer for $4 million. So it costs $250,000 a year for the power to run it. But those are reasonable numbers, and so and Chime is the Chime team in Canada has been developing this technology now for about 3 or 4 years, and it's becoming mature, and we're basically copying Chime here. Right, so it doesn't. It's a different concept. I wanted to try the correlator's copy. So once the signals come from the antenna, you don't care what the shape of the antenna is, right? Yeah.
Are there any different capabilities to Chime?
Yeah, so Chime is a cylinder technology, which we prototyped at Pittsburgh long ago. So that looks at a strip of sky continuously, and therefore sees this whole sky every day. This looks with higher gain at a small field of sky, a 6-degree field of sky. It doesn't see the other declinations unless you tilt it. So we would tilt it gradually over time. So Chime sees the whole sky every day with lower sensitivity. We see smaller fields of sky with higher sensitivity. They will drift scan and will manually change the declination occasionally. That's the plan. That's just to save money. You could put motors on them. It wouldn't actually be that expensive. Right.
So what is that thing on the right?
These panels, so we put this together in my lab in Pittsburgh, and we shipped it to South Africa, and this is it arriving in South Africa.
It's like a bed.
Yeah, it's just these panels all stacked on top of each other.
Some bed.
Yeah.
What's the
game
difference between this and steadfast?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this is equivalent to a 200-meter telescope once you phase all the elements. FAST is effectively a 300-meter telescope, so a factor 2 smaller in collecting area, right? But this synthesizes 1,000 simultaneous beams on the sky, which FAST can't do. So in terms of mapping speed, it's substantially faster than FAST. But in terms of raw gain for a single source, it's half. A very interesting aspect of this technology is you can incrementally add more dishes without any leap of technology required. If you try to make single dishes bigger and bigger, you sort of run out of ability to make anything bigger than you're already making. That's already happening. FAST is turning out to be very hard to make work. We tried to go up factor 2-ish from Arecibo, and it turned out to be really hard to do that. But here, we just keep adding dishes till we run out of money, right? And you can keep going ad infinitum, really, as long as you've got money. There's no technological barrier. And when you add a dish to an array like this, you're increasing the collecting area, but you're also increasing the number of beams you synthesize on the sky. So the mapping speed goes as the square of the cost, right? It's very important. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not very expensive. This is $7 million all up for the hardware cost. This is, by modern costs, this is not very high. Okay.
So this will have roughly the same capabilities, Charlie?
Roughly, yeah. And the idea is to do the intensity map in both hemispheres. Mm-hmm. For intensity mapping, they're roughly equivalent. For the radio bursts, this actually has some advantages, the dishes. Yeah. It's still, of course, for intensity mapping, the key thing is the number of channels. Just like a CMB telescope, you don't get better sensitivity the larger dish, right? CMB, you get a different angular scale, but the delta T sensitivity is independent of the size. Yeah. Now one of the things we're going to do with HyREX is to add a few small outrigger arrays. So these are groups of 8 elements. We don't need very many. And we want them at various angles to create a dilute interferometer. The detection of the radio bursts will come from the main 1,000-element array. But once we've found one, we know its dispersion measure, and we know roughly where it is on the sky. And we'll point 8 dishes at each of these 3 sites at the same location. And then we can synthesize a beam using that array that tells us the position of the object. It's a high signal-to-noise object at this point. So basically, you're using the signal from this dish array as a template to find it, even though it's weak in the smaller arrays. And then this is once again a calculation by Alex here of this beam pattern that you get. This is 2 arc seconds, right? So this is this very, very sharp localization. And we'll essentially get this for every event you believe. So we need about signal to noise of 15 to get a publishable FRB. If you've got signal to noise of 15, that's enough to get the signal from the small arrays and find the position. So we'll be getting 10 a day, and we'll know the position of everyone to a little spiral piece of a spiral arm of a particular galaxy. So that will be revolutionary for this field, right? You'll now know, are they coming from galactic centers? Are they coming from spirals? What are the redshifts of all these galaxies? Actually, doing the redshift follow-up, it's 10 a day. So, you know, getting 10 optical redshifts at redshift 1 a day is not so easy. So it's going to create a lot of work for other astronomers. Right. There's also CHIME, and CHIME will come online first. And CHIME is nearing completion, actually, so will be completed in 2017. It's made of cylinders. What to say about CHIME? It's also going to detect a lot of FRBs, but we do have a plan to do a little bit of interferometry with CHIME. So CHIME will be over here in British Columbia. These cylinders looking at a stripe of sky will pick a piece of that stripe and point 2 large-ish radio dishes into that field. There are a couple of basically unused 40-meter dishes in the US and Canada, one at Algonquin Radio Observatory as a 40-meter dish that's basically sitting there rusting. And there's the 140-foot that was used for CMB years ago that is now used as a satellite downlink for Radio Astron. That's its only purpose. It's only used half-time for that. It's in Green Bank, yeah. Now that they've got the 100-meter, the 40-meter dish just sits there. For radio bursts, you need lots of time, but you don't need to track. So we'll just, the plan is to point these into CHIME's meridian at the same spot, and now we have a triangle. Now, the events that CHIME will see 10 a day, only a few of them will be in the field of view of this telescope. So we're only going to get like 1 a month here. But this allows us to practice right away this interferometry technique and get a handful of sharp localizations right now. So if all goes well, we'll have this working in a year. Okay, so conclusions. It looks like these radio bursts are extragalactic. The evidence is still kind of thin, but it does look like that's true. We have this crazy inferred isotropic brightness temperature, ignoring the fact that they're likely beamed, of 10 to the 34 Kelvin. It's a challenge to theorists to explain both that and the 5,000 per day all sky. We're going to make dense interferometers. There's one in China I didn't talk about, Tianlai, CHIME, and HIREX, that will detect 10 a day. We'll use outriggers on HIREX. So because it's made of 6-meter dishes, we cover exactly the same main field with other 6-meter dishes, right? So we can match the coverage of HIREX with the outriggers quite easily, but just by using the very same dishes in a small array. So it's particularly easy to do this for HIREX. And then once we have galaxy IDs, we'll know redshifts, and we can search for supernova remnants and synchrotron emission from those remnants. Search optically in radio. We could stack them and look for gamma flux. All kinds of things like that will become possible once we have a large data set with sharp positioning. Okay, that's all I have to say. You asked so many questions. You must. Oh, he left though.
When do you think they'd
IREX outriggers?
Yeah, we can. Well, IREX was originally conceived as an intensity mapping telescope without the radio burst science goal. But the first subarray, go back and. Oh, oops. Now I've done it. Let's do it this way. This one. Okay, so this is the Hart Radio Observatory here, and that's our prototype site, and we have 8 dishes there already, of which 6 have been put on the sky. So that's our first outrigger already. So we'll have that one, and then we'll start building out this array. And this is in Botswana. We have a proposal in to a joint Canadian, Gary Hinshaw's involved in that, and a joint Canadian South African Botswana proposal to put an array there. If that gets approved, that'll happen within a year. And then all we have to do is build another in the Durban area, go to the outskirts where the radio noise is not so bad. So that's quite easy to do. So I'm thinking 2 years, we should have that running with a, not with the full array at the core yet, but maybe 64 dishes at the core, and that's enough to start getting a handful of sharp localizations. Yeah, 2 years.
The main criterion for these sites is low radio noise.
It's yeah. So that's a hard question to answer. Both the Penticton site, and this Hart-Rau site are not really very quiet. And we're getting away with it so far. So this is an extremely quiet site, right? This is the SKA site. So that's as good as you get on a big continent. Yeah. We're getting away with it with poor medium quality or poorish quality radio for the radio bursts because they have such a distinct signature, and that's why we're getting away with it.
It just strikes me that setting up additional outriggers in different countries in Africa would be extremely exciting.
You want to get away from civilization where you can go out into the bush. These arrays are quite inexpensive. It's eight cheap dishes and a little rack of electronics. You need an Ethernet connection, which can be hard.
Maybe you said this. Are you set up to do follow this up optically in real time? So if there's some transient or any other wavelength?
We've been thinking about that a lot recently. There is one radio burst for which there is a 3-sigma evidence for a gamma ray burst at the same instant. The time window is 40 seconds long in the gamma data. But that bin does have a 3-sigma outlying positive event coincident with the radio burst. Now, if that's true, if you have a prompt gamma burst and radio burst, you very likely have an optical burst too. And I don't think millisecond optical bursts have gotten a lot of attention from observers. Wide field searches for millisecond optical bursts, I don't think a lot of that has been done. Millisecond is hard to do optically, right? Usually you want integration time to do optical astronomy, right? So this is video cameras, right? Fast video cameras. So I don't think there's been much of it. I would love to build a 6-degree field millisecond optical camera with a big aperture, and look in coincidence with the radio data. Yeah?
Old LSST?
LSST is not that fast. There's no millisecond data from LSST. Yeah, they consider a transient to be a supernova that lasts a week, right? Yeah. Asteroids, some asteroids, right? But once again, they're not doing millisecond cadence with LSST. They would be awash in data, right? They couldn't handle it, right? That's too fast, so. So probably what we would do is select the data. When we see a radio burst, we'd save the data, and otherwise we'd throw it away. So not much thought has gone into this, really. But it's a good idea to do a coincident optical search. It's a good idea. Yeah.
So you showed us that slide with like the FRB signal, the pulsar signal, the RFI. Is that classification made by hand, or do you have some algorithm to do it or something?
We've improved our RFI cutting in advance of Now we would have only 200 false positives to find the one real event with our more modern RFI filters. But that's still a problem. It's done by hand so far, human beings. When we have 10 a day, that can't be true anymore. So we need machine learning. We're working on it.
We've done a lot of work on this for time, where you have to start searching 1,000 genes in a few months. And we have the false positive rate now, which is like one every few hundred hours.
If you accept only the high signal to noise events, the classification becomes fairly easy. Yeah. So you're throwing away the dim ones in order to avoid false positives, which is always true.
Right. Yeah, so I think all this is absolutely amazing. And you're doing it so cheaply. It's incredible. But do you have an idea for
Oh, of course. Yes.
What's your, billion-dollar
version? Well, we got to get this done first, and that occupies my every waking hour, right? But of course, we have a plan. So what I'd like to do next is super hyrax, which is just number of elements times 10. No new technology, just spend more money, right? And that would have an FRV every minute. Every minute. Yeah. Amazing. And that would cost about $50 million. And that's without economies of scale. Maybe technology for making dishes can become cheaper. And maybe you can use ASICs.
What about the computer to cope with that? Isn't that a major?
Well, we need 10 times the computer. Yeah.
Is there any 10?
No, most of it, all the algorithms are n log n. So essentially, it's linear. Yeah, that's true, wouldn't you say?
It depends on whether you say the full visibility matrix or just the intensities and the regular array of values. In China, we do say the full visibility matrix.
But you don't need that for FRBs. You don't need that for FRBs.
You don't need that.
For FRBs, everything's n log n. For the intensity mapping, you probably do want some n squared data. Maybe not all of it, but a fraction of it for calibration purposes. So that's harder. Intensity mapping, yes.
Well, the computer
for 4 million times 10, 40.
So times 100 is 400 million.
Well, I would just go 10 now. But if you want to go to the next step, well, so then you start exploiting economies of scale, right?
Yep.
So now you have tens of millions of dollars for correlator technology, and you could pay for ASICs to be designed, and there's a lot you can do. Once you have a sustaining flow of money in terms of economies of scale.
There's also the Moore's Law exponential
thing. There's Moore's Law.
It's slowing down.
Yeah.
It's slowing down. It's not
producing. It's slowing down.
Processor twice the capability of reading. It is slowing down. It's already slowed down.
Yeah, but if it's 40 million and we get it one more factor of two, it's only 20, right? Yeah, I don't know how you get to scaling by 100. I haven't thought about that. I've only thought about scaling by 10. And maybe I should be bolder. Should we spend $1 billion on this?
Yes.
But to pay the power bill, too, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So actually, doesn't SKA do something similar, or what is the company?
We're occupying a little bit different niche from SKA. We're concentrating on sensitivity. We're essentially creating a single dish telescope out of a dense array. And that saves us a lot of money compared to SKA, who they have arms that go way out in order to achieve high angular resolution. And then their data is very fine on the sky. And so, this technology is specific to our application, and it's much more.
But given that SKA is happening anyway,
The proper way to do this is to make call this a developer for SKA.
Yes.
Okay.
And everything we learn will be useful to them, and declare non-competition. Right.
Yeah.
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 They're complementary. They're
surveying, and SKA is focusing in on particular sources.
That's right. And you'll still want SKA to study these sources.
All right, if there are no more questions, let's thank you.